Hi, I'm David Twitchell. It's WHFR's 40th birthday and the 18th anniversary of We Are Not Alone on WHFR Radio. Now, last week was the best of week, so to honor the event, we will be taking a look back at some of the We Are Not Alone shows. We will play clips from shows with guests like Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Philip Imbrogno, Bud Hopkins, Linda Moulton Howe, Travis Walton, and Richard Dolan. So please stay tuned for a look at the UFO phenomenon through the eyes of those whose exhaustive research have helped expose the truth. So in honor of our anniversary, I'd like to play a few clips from past shows that touch on several aspects of the UFO phenomenon. I call it the best of We Are Not Alone, and I hope you enjoy it. Although anomalous aerial phenomena have been reported throughout history, the modern UFO era began in June of 1947 with the crash of a flying disc in Roswell, New Mexico. At first, this fact was admitted by the commander of the 509th Bombardment Group stationed in Roswell, stationed at the Roswell Army Airfield. And of course, the next day they recanted, declaring the debris to be that of a weather balloon, just a mundane weather balloon. And this debate raged for years between ufologists and debunkers. And on October 5th, 2010, I had the distinct honor of interviewing the sixth man to walk on the face of the moon, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, who, at least in my estimation, put that debate to rest. So let's hear some of the testimony, a short clip of the testimony from that show. Yeah, you made international news a couple years ago after an interview on Kerrang Radio in England.
That was quite a surprise, too.
It was a surprise for the host, too.
we were suddenly... Simple statement I'd made many times. Huh? All of a sudden, we were international almost overnight. Huh? I was getting calls from all over the world within the next week.
Right.
Just because of that one interview.
Yeah, he acted like he discovered peanut butter, you know?
Something.
But in it, you told the host that UFOs are real, and Roswell was a real event, and it really created a firestorm.
Yeah, it sure certainly did.
Yeah.
And that had, I'm not quite sure why that happened, but it happened that way.
Well,
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, did the host of that radio show notify mass media? Guess what I just found out?
No, I don't think so, because I don't think so, because I had made those same statements quite frequently mm-hmm. in public domain, on radio, on interviews like this.
Mm.
It wasn't anything particularly new or revolutionary from my point of view. I told my Roswell story. I grew up there,
okay.
And told my story of that. I've told it several times. But all of a sudden, within 1 week of that Kerrang radio interview, I was suddenly international with that story.
Yeah. Okay, so for the benefit of our listeners here at WHFR who have not had the pleasure of hearing your Roswell story, please repeat it. Maybe I can make international news. You know.
Okay. We'll give it a try.
Give it a shot.
Well, the fact is, you see, I grew up in Roswell, New Mexico,
mm-hmm.
In the Pecos Valley, and where the site of the so-called Roswell incident in 1947 took place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have to set the scene here a little bit. The Pecos Valley in eastern New Mexico in those days was rather sparsely settled. That whole area of the Pecos River running up and down the eastern side of New Mexico, that whole area didn't have more than 50,000 people in it up for 100 miles or so. And my family, my grandfather in particular, was a 19th century rancher, entrepreneur,
mm.
and very good at it, and cattle trader. And he helped introduce the Hereford cattle, the white-faced Hereford cattle, into the West to replace the rangy Texas Longhorns as beef cattle. They were far better beef cattle. And anyhow, that was his job. And the family lost everything in the Depression of the 1930s. But grandfather had brought the family back, and by the mid-40s, rather prosperous ranchers and farmers, and had several farm machinery dealerships. And so we lived there in the Roswell area, and the family knew most of the people up and down, the large numbers of the people up and down around the Roswell area. And so when the Roswell incident took place, I was headed off for college. And on one day, in the Roswell Daily Record, there was a story of the crash of an alien spacecraft a few miles to the north and west of Roswell. And the next day, it was replaced by a story that said, no, it was just a weather balloon. And so I was going off to college. I didn't pay much attention to it. Okay, that's the way it is. And then I went off to the moon, of course, quite a few years later. And when I came back, I went to visit friends. My family had already left the area, and my father was already passed away. But I went back to the area to visit friends, and was, I invited to deliver some lectures and talk about going to the moon, which I did. And the some of the local folks who the family knew, as I said, we knew most everybody up and down that area. Some of the local folks tugged my sleeve at my appearances and said, could we talk a little bit? And they told me their story of this, or the story of their family, notably folks like the Undertaker, who provided small coffins to the Air Force Base for the bodies of the dead aliens, and people in the sheriff's office who had helped with traffic control and had done some work for the military in managing that in around the Roswell incident. And they told me, because they had been shushed to never talk about this at all by the military at the time that the Roswell incident took place. And frankly, on the theory, or rather on the fear of considerable sanctions if they talked. And here I was, a local boy that was now kind of famous, been to the moon. And they wanted to tell me their story. So eventually I took that story to the Pentagon and told it. And long story short, in got it confirmed in a rather circuitous way, which we'll talk about another time. But in other words, it was confirmed. And so that's the basis of my knowledge, my early knowledge of the UFO phenomenon, that we had, there was a crashed UFO. And the reason more likely for all of that is because the White Sands Proving Ground was right across the mountains where the first atomic weapons were tested, and also the Roswell Army Air Force Base. Now, it became the Roswell Air Force Base when it when the Air Force became a separate service, but that was right in Roswell. And so one can conjecture that the alien craft was, as we have had quite a few incidents where alien craft are around our nuclear facilities and around the rocket facilities that are launched, designed to launch weapons. So one can conjecture, although I don't know this for sure, one can conjecture that that was their interest as was the White Sands Proving Ground and the nuclear weapons that had been tested there, and so on and so forth.
And that was astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon. And on January 1st, 2009, Philip Imbrogno was our guest. Mr. Imbrogno has been a science educator for more than 20 years and a UFO investigator for more than 30 years, and he is the author of Night Siege, the Hudson Valley UFO mystery. So let's listen to a clip from that show. Now, in 1983, the Northeast Coast was inundated with a UFO flap that came to be known as the Hudson Valley sightings. You wrote the book on that. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, that's really the case that that really allowed me to investigate a large bulk of UFO reports. I'll never forget it because on March 25th, 1983, I was coming out of a diner in Porchester, New York, and the mailman, who I knew, and he knew I had an interest in UFOs, came running up to me and said, Phil, did you see it? The headlines, 100 see UFOs. I said, no, I didn't heard of it. I haven't heard about it. So he showed me the paper, the headline in the Westchester Gannett chain, the newspaper for that area, the Hudson Valley, and it said, the heading, hundreds claimed to see UFOs on March 24th, the night before. I picked up the paper, and I read the article, and it was so fascinating, and they had names of people in there. I started calling some of these people, and every time I called someone, I got the names of 10 more people who saw the UFO.
Huh.
And in a very short time, I had hundreds of people who on March 24th, 1983, saw this enormous UFO. And the thing about it is that there were so many people who saw this object, people from all walks of life, police officers, pilots, scientists, educators, engineers, air traffic controllers, meteorologists, people, you know, people who work for IBM, top IBM executives, people who had a standing in the community, people who never really thought about UFOs before. Yet, on that particular night, in the nights to follow, many of these people just stopped their cars, got out of their cars, looking up at the sky, watching an object that was very well lit with multicolored lights that was reported to be the size of an aircraft carrier silently drift across the sky at low altitude. At times, it projected down a beam of light. Now, the people who saw this, once again, were people who didn't care about UFOs.
Right.
Yet on that night, they all became believers. And to this day, they still claim that what they encountered that night was something not from this world. So, you know, this went on until the 1990s, and the bulk of the sightings, however, occurred between 1982 and 1985. Total to date, probably over 7,000 people have seen this object, including myself.
Yeah.
And that's a conservative number. These are people whose standing in the community was so solid that their testimony would not be questioned in a court of law. You know, these people who saw this object is that they were so startled as this object passed over,
right,
that many of them said to me later that they wanted to get home because they thought there was an invasion.
Mm-hmm.
A local newspaper, the North County News, ran a story the following day comparing what happened that night to like a scare of like the War of the Worlds.
Right.
People were calling the police stations, and the lights at the police stations, the lines were flooded with calls as police officers were sent after this object, seeing it, reporting in, very exciting. I mean, you couldn't get a better scene in a sci-fi movie, you know, about UFOs and alien visitors.
Right.
It was like a sci-fi movie.
Well, from what you're describing here from 83, it sounds very much like the Phoenix Lights incident.
That's true.
Was it that same shape, the boomerang or triangular shape craft?
That's right. You see, the front of the lights resemble a boomerang. However, behind that boomerang is a dark structure that goes triangular in shape.
Okay.
That is triangular in shape.
Nice.
Now, on July 24th, 1984, the object was seen over five or six counties from Connecticut all the way to New York, and was seen by thousands of people. In 1984, it was videotaped in Brewster, New York.
Mm-hmm.
15 minutes later, after that videotape was taken, the object hovered above the Indian Point nuclear reactor in Buchanan, New York, which is right on the Hudson, dividing, you know, the east side of the Hudson, the west side of the Hudson, on the eastern shore of the Hudson. Now, that object came over the only reactor that was in service at the time, reactor number 3, hovered above there for 15 minutes. The New York State Power Authority police officers who witnessed this, 12 of them, got right under it and noticed that it was triangular in shape with a boomerang-shaped pattern of lights in the front. It was dark gray material, and underneath there were circular-like areas in which the areas were large enough to fit cars into it. They estimated that the size from end to end was 900 feet, and there was no sound. One of the security officers inside the console, inside the plant, told me that he had to pan his camera, his security camera, 180 degrees so that he can look at the entire object. Now, this is one of the only cases in which a UFO was definitely confirmed over an active nuclear reactor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, later on, Indian Point itself, a fellow by the name of Carl Patrick, who was the spokesman for the plant at the time, he was being barraged by media saying, you know, we saw the thing over Indian Point, and he confirmed the sighting. Now, one reporter asked him, did the guards fire on the object? And he said, I cannot confirm or deny that they fired on the object, but they did what was necessary to protect the plant. And you know what? They fired on the object, and they had a helicopter come from Camp Smith, a gunship, and they fired on the object, and there was no effect. This is the information that I got, but they will not confirm or deny that they fired on this the Hudson Valley UFO.
Isn't that something like you ask someone at, Edwards Air Force Base, you know, you have UFOs here, captured UFOs or bodies here at Edwards Air Force Base. They say, we cannot confirm nor deny. You ask them if they have anything on Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny, they'll laugh at you and say, of course not. But when you ask them about an alien craft, they say, we cannot confirm nor deny. Do you notice the difference there?
Well, to me, that's a confirmation that they knew something went wrong, but they don't know the entire story.
Right.
But they're sure something happened.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the videotape that we have of the Hudson Valley UFO, this is the only UFO videotape that was looked at by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California.
Okay, now you've seen this film, right?
Oh, the videotape?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, back in 1984, we displayed it on CNN. You know, Ted Turner gave us a call.
Mm.
It was first, you know, on CNN. And of course, you know, the FAA and the Air Force comes forward with this explanation that the Hudson Valley UFO was nothing more than a bunch of hang gliders with lights on them.
Hang gliders.
Yeah, hang gliders. And then they said ultralight aircraft, which is like, you know, an open kind of craft with just a motor on it, a lawnmower on it, and a light.
Right, right.
And that the pilots hung colored lanterns from the bottom of the object. Then they later said that the Hudson Valley UFO was nothing more than a bunch of small aircraft flying in close formation, 6 inches from wingtip to wingtip.
Wow.
I mean, that's impossible, because at one particular sighting, The winds gusted up to 30 knots. Any small aircraft, there would be enough motion between there that these craft would go colliding into each other.
Certainly.
Yet this object was rigid in the wind. But so, you know, that's fine and dandy. You know, the FAA wants to play these games and so on and try to quiet down the people. I can see from a logical point of view. Mm-hmm. But the Jet Propulsion Laboratory looked at the tape. The only thing we wanted to know, did the lights on that tape, that videotape, represent one rigid object, one solid object, or individual objects in formation? Their conclusions were that the object was one rigid object, ruling out the plane in formation theory for the Hudson Valley UFO.
And that was Philip Imbrogno from our show on New Year's Day, 2009. And you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, 89.3 FM on your radio, and WHFR.FM on your computer. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone, and I'm David Twitchell. So continuing on, now on December 1st, 2007, I had the pleasure of speaking with the late Bud Hopkins. Bud is considered to be a pioneer in the investigation of alleged alien abduction victims by means of regression hypnosis. He's the author of Witnessed, the Brooklyn Bridge UFO Abduction, Missing Time, Intruders, and Sight Unseen. So let's listen now to that clip from the show with Bud Hopkins.
The comparing notes. Now, that's I'm not trying to change the subject here, but going back to the abduction phenomenon.
Yes.
People used to believe, you know, the psychiatrist, psychologist would get these people in there. You know, I've had this this experience where I've been abducted by these beings, and I saw a UFO, and all of this good stuff. All around the world, and of course they just wrote it out as schizophrenia or delusional or whatever. And it wasn't really until Betty and Barney Hill came out with their story of their abduction that the psychiatrists and psychologists started comparing notes from around the world and saying, you know what, this is happening all over the world.
Yeah, well, it actually didn't happen until sometime after the Betty and Barney Hill thing, and then it's come in a steady stream. And I've had so far 8 psychiatrists come to me about their own personal abduction experiences, and a number of psychologists and therapists who were abductees themselves.
Oh, I see.
So, I mean, it's
Have they sought
one of the
treatment?
Interesting things, of course, is how glibly people can say, well, hallucination or something. Of course, it's always somebody like the late Carl Sagan, who was not a psychiatrist, that was not his field, who would bounce around words like hallucination and delusion and so forth. But the point is that when these people had been tested psychologically by very objective tests by people who didn't even know what the reports were that these people were making, they don't turn up to be at all mentally ill or anything.
Right.
So that whole theory has just kind of gone down the tubes.
Right.
We do run into mentally ill people, that's for sure, that's something you usually can pick up fairly fast.
Yeah, I think a psychiatrist, a psychologist could pick that up pretty fast, too.
Yep.
But, yeah, I remember there was a study done on that. It was a blind test where abductees went in, did not tell them that what they were there for, just wanted a psychological evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And they came back clean. They were perfectly all right. But they all seemed to share One trait: they seem to be suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yes,
and that was the fact, you know, something very traumatic had happened in their lives.
And in many of these cases, because I've had therapists refer some of their patients to me, I'm not a therapist, but at least I can help them get back at whatever the experience was that caused the trauma, and. So what happens is when they look into their experiences, the trauma that was, the effects of which were there, but there was no particular cause. People have gone to psychiatrists for years trying to figure out what had happened to them, mm-hmm. even though there, you know, there was no sense of sexual abuse or incest or terrible accidents or deaths or the kinds of things that can cause PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
Once the UFO experiences come to light, the psychiatrists and therapists will all say, well, that's what did it.
That's what did it. What's what did it? The abduction?
The abduction, yep.
So the psychiatrists, psychologists have finally come to the conclusion, or some have come to the conclusion that I guess what they're saying must be the truth.
Yeah, that's happened in many cases. But, and I think just it's worth telling one example. A man who had been with a therapist for years with PTSD symptoms and so forth, and the man was an expert, the therapist, in PTSD, had a lot of Vietnam vets in his practice and all that.
Hmm.
And they couldn't locate any real trauma in his life.
Hmm.
And ultimately, because he told a friend about a lot of odd experiences he'd had, the friend urged him to write to me. And so when I dealt with him, what he was telling me involved a huge UFO near his car, three other people in the car with him, and a period of missing time, which lasted maybe 5 hours.
Hmm.
And he remembers being terrified after that, but they couldn't remember what actually happened during the 5 hours. None of the four of them could. And when I did hypnosis, and out came the experience, he was absolutely terrified, shocked, as he was reliving it.
Right.
And I told him to go back, when he went back home, to call his therapist right away and make an appointment. And this man was really shattered. And he called the therapist, and when I called this individual to find out how it was going, I said, what happened when you told your therapist about this? And he said, well, he believed me. He believed that this is what caused my experience, my PTSD. And I said, oh, that's very good. And he said, no, it isn't. He said, I wanted him to tell me that there was a mental problem I had, something could be fixed. This is not something that can be fixed. And he said, I cancel all my appointments with this man. I'll never see him again.
Oh, my God.
So upset was he at the idea that what he had remembered was actually being confirmed as the probable cause by his therapist.
Mm.
Nobody likes to know to believe this, you know.
Yeah.
That was the late Bud Hopkins. His passing on August 21st, 2011, leaves a big hole in the investigation of abduction phenomenon. So Linda Moulton Howe joined the show on March 7, 2007. And Ms. Howe is an Emmy Award-winning TV and documentary producer. She's an investigative reporter, noted for her work in crop formations and cattle mutilations. And she is the author of A Strange Harvest, An Alien Harvest, and Glimpses of Other Realities. So let's hear the clip from that show.
In the summer of 1979, there were news reports all over Colorado and the surrounding states about the resurgence, the repeating of unusual animal deaths, largely cattle, but horses and every domestic animal you can think of, as well as wild game such as deer and elk, all found with the same excisions of an ear, eye, jaw flesh, tongue, genitals, and rectal or vaginal area, cored out with no blood. And I wanted to get to the bottom of it. And it took me into law enforcement offices, in which at the beginning of my research in the fall of 79, I had sheriffs telling me, Linda, we're not dealing with predators and we're not dealing with people. We're dealing with something from outer space.
The sheriffs told you that.
Oh, yeah, right from the beginning. And the problem was that not any of those law enforcement would go on the camera in front. I'm doing television.
Yeah.
If they don't go on, I'm not going to be summarizing unless I'm forced to.
Right.
And it was October of 1979 down in Trinidad, Colorado, 10 o'clock in the evening. The crew and I were on 23-day journey in a Channel 7 station wagon, chock full of gear, and we were going wherever the story took me from day to day as the producer, writer, director, editor, and reporter. Mm. And that, and I've been asking everywhere we went. I've been asking ranchers. I have been asking law enforcement, who or what do you think is killing and mutilating these animals? And I got a wide variety of answers, sort of walking around the sensitive subject of extraterrestrials.
Mm-hmm.
And now at 10 o'clock in the evening, sitting across from Lou Giroto, who was the chief investigator of the district attorney's office in Trinidad, he looked straight at me and he said, well, Linda, other investigators and I have come to the conclusion we're dealing with creatures not from this planet.
Hmm.
And then he continued to elaborate, and I remember sitting there feeling like, oh, my God, finally, a breakthrough. Somebody with real firsthand knowledge in law enforcement is saying it straightforwardly on the camera with the film running. And Lou went ahead to explain how they had so-called dark helicopters, mm-hmm. reported by people that would dissolve in the air in front of people that cannot be a conventional helicopter.
The helicopters?
That he and deputies had their own firsthand experiences with red, orange, large lights that they saw from their cars, from their law enforcement cars. One case he told me about I've never forgotten. They had gotten a call at the law enforcement office that there was a unidentified that was racing south from, it was Denver, Stapleton. It picked it up on radar, and Lou Giroto and the office there got the message that this unidentified was heading south. Trinidad is south of Denver by car, my gosh, nearly 4 hours. But if something is moving more than 1,000 miles an hour, it doesn't take them long to get there. So Lou and a deputy sheriff had gone up on a hill in Trinidad in order to look where they had have a vantage point, and they said, my God, this huge orange thing, it looked like a full moon, but orange, kind of fiery looking, showed up in the sky, went straight down into the ground from their perspective, and they were looking at each other, what is this? How can it go down straight into the ground when this thing came straight back up out of the ground, split in two? It looked identical, each now two of these orange, red, orangey, fiery objects. Mm. One went straight north, one went straight south. The deputy and Lou Giroto said they sat there saying to each other, what are we dealing with here? And then the two red, orange, fiery objects came back together and went down into the ground again. And he said every single time that these red, orange objects showed up, reported by ranchers or the law enforcement, they had mutilations. And that has been one of the most, I would say, one of the most solid common denominators around the world. When these strange, fiery, red, orange, unidentified aerial objects show up, there are animal mutilations in the region that people see them.
Okay, now, a lot of people will say, okay, that just because there's some lights, you know, could be natural phenomenon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which could explain the crop formations. But describe a typical cattle mutilation and tell me how a light or some kind of natural phenomenon, ball lightning or whatever you want to call it, could accomplish this?
No. Right from the very beginning of my research, because of my background in medicine and science, the first place that I went was the University of Colorado, veterinarian pathologist. I was reaching out to people that I could go and get hair, get tissue, whatever I could get as physical evidence and go to scientists for some kind of feedback. I did that right from the very beginning.
Mm.
And early on, it was so clear that whatever was happening with the excisions, this was with a laser specialist, and in 79, this was an early, early field. I went to a laser specialist at the University of Colorado Medical Center, and I took him photographs from sheriff's offices. I had a whole lot, and I laid them out, and I said, is there any instrument that you know that could do this? And he said, that reminds me of what lasers do in the sense that there's no blood and there seems to be a slightly darkened edge. But he said the size of these excisions, it would take hours. And I said, can you set up a surgery room and do a demonstration for me on camera that so I can see the comparison between a laser, a cautery, and a scalpel? And he said, yes. And that's one of my most famous scenes in my documentary, A Strange Harvest, mm-hmm. is watching this laser surgeon at the University of Colorado Medical Center do a comparison and how long. I had a stopwatch. And when he did a laser excision that was 1 3/4 inches in diameter, it took him 17 minutes to do that much. Mm-hmm. To do an excision of an udder on a cow, it, as he said, with the equipment that was state-of-the-art then, it would have taken hours. Not possible. Further, his laser surgery looked brown, looked cooked. It left carbon residue. In the cattle mutilations, there is no carbon residue. That was one of the facts that came into focus when John Altshuler, a hematologist and pathologist, quietly came to me in 1988 and said that he was retiring to have his own lab, would be free from the concerns of a university medical center, and that he wanted to help me because he had other background information on the fact that he had seen the Snippy case, which was actually a horse named Lady back in 67. He was just beginning his career. He had gone down there out of curiosity. He was the famous unknown medical doctor who was showed up that Burl Lewis, who owned that famous horse from September of 67, said a doctor came from Denver to look at that horse. Well, it was John Altshuler, which I write all about this in my first book, An Alien Harvest, which came out in 1989,
mm-hmm.
and did
book.
So with John Altshuler's approval and permission. And he continued then throughout the 80s and the early 90s to help me. I would go out with a formalin solution and a scalpel and bottles and bags and containers, and I would cut. I have done this on 20, 30 animals. I would cut from the mutilator's excisions, put it in formalin solution for preservation, also gathered soil and plants that would go to biophysicist W.C. Levengood.
Mm-hmm.
So I had
right
a hematologist, pathologist helping me with the tissue.
Mm-hmm.
I had the biophysicist helping me with the soil and the plants. And the data that those two men alone began reporting, John Altshuler said, Linda, the collagen has been cooked in these excisions. The hemoglobin has been cooked. But when he went to laser surgeons and said, I need to compare the photomicrographs of what we are seeing on these mutilated animals with normal known laser surgery on humans or large animals like horses, there was, and I sat in his office and looked. He would show me one slide that was from a current animal mutilation case, and it was a photomicrograph, a photomicrograph is a microscopic view of the tissue. And then we would look at the human surgery or the horse surgery, and here was this black carbon exactly as the doctor in the University of Colorado had been able to demonstrate when I was doing A Strange Harvest.
Mm-hmm.
And John Altshuler said, Linda, we have never yet seen carbon residue on any of these unusual animal deaths. What is the instrument that is doing the cutting?
Mm-hmm.
And then jump to the eyewitnesses. There have been many, many eyewitnesses who have seen beams come down in their pasture and have watched animals go up in beams or be lowered.
Mm-hmm.
There were cowboys. It ended up in the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News back in the 70s. There were cowboys at a ranch, and they saw what they said were small, gray, non-human beings who floated in the air over a corral into a corral, and that animal ended up mutilated. The list is endless.
And that was Linda Moulton Howe, on webmaster for earthfiles.com. And you're listening to WHFR.FM. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. And for a glimpse into what it's like during a conscious alien abduction, who better to relate the that haunting memory than Travis Walton? Travis is the author and subject of the movie version of Fire in the Sky. And on June 1st, 2010, we were fortunate enough to have him on the line with us. So let's listen to the clip from that show.
When I woke up, I was in a lot of pain. I didn't know where I was. I was in and out of consciousness for a long time. I'd kind of like come to, but the pain, it was kind of like a semi-coma, you know, sort of a thing where I was in and out. But
did your body feel tingling? Or?
Yeah, it was sort of a burning, tingling. It was sort of a pain that centered in my upper body and diminished outward from there. And at first I didn't know where I was or what had happened. Then I remembered I had gone up. I'd seen this thing in the woods. Then I thought, well, I must have been hurt somehow, and they took me to a hospital. Because I was lying on a hard surface, and I could see a light above me, like a light fixture. Hmm. It really hurt to open my eyes against the light. You know, I wasn't all that bright. It was just part of the pain I was in.
Right.
So I could hear the sounds of movement around me, and I figured that I'd been taken to a hospital, and these were, you know, people, you know, hospital personnel. And I was having a lot of trouble focusing my eyes. Pain, and I couldn't catch my breath, and it seemed like I just couldn't get enough air. When I could finally focus my eyes, I could see that this was not a doctor standing over me. I was looking into the face of this strange creature, you know. I first took it to be like a surgical cap and mask, you know.
Right.
But the darker area in between was actually these huge eyes. And I just freaked out. I guess I kind of went nuts for a while, you know. It was the shock of what I was seeing.
Right.
And plus the kind of the panicky feeling that you get from almost suffocating. Just couldn't seem to get enough air. Kind of like it was sort of a, I already had a physiological basis for panic, and then I see these creatures, and I look around, and I'm in this cramped little room, and dimly lit, and, you know, the claustrophobic thing was just really just added to the whole thing of feeling trapped.
Right.
So I was really kind of berserk. The fear allowed me to get up. I had this thing over me, some kind of a machine that was laying on my chest, but I didn't care at that point. I was just wanted to get away from them.
How many were there? How many?
There was three. There was two on my right and one on my left, and I tried to, you know, strike out at them. But I was so weak, it was just kind of like a wave of my arm, really. I made contact with his chest, and he fell back into the other one. And then I got off the table, and this thing fell off of me, and they started around the table towards me, and I just, that just, you know, added to the panic I was feeling. I stumbled back until my leg hit this sort of a workbench there. And I looked back, and there was an array of instruments and things there. I was just looking for something to throw at him or to defend myself with.
How tall were these beings?
They weren't huge. That wasn't where my fear came from. They were rather small creatures. Even though I was so weak, he'd just fallen back so easily.
Right, arms and legs and head.
Yeah, they were humanoid, you know. Right. They had two arms, two legs, and the head. They were hairless, though.
Right.
And they had these huge eyes.
Hmm.
The basic sort of a human arrangement of body parts, but something completely, you know.
Not human, right?
I grabbed this thin glass I don't know if it's glass. It was a clear plastic or a tube or rod, and wasn't all that big, but I, you know, it was something I could, the biggest thing there.
Right.
And so I swung it at them and made striking motions. They weren't close enough to hit. I was really making a threatening gesture.
Mm-hmm.
Keep them away from me, and I was screaming, get back, stay away from me, and all that.
Right.
But they stopped, and, you know, their gaze, the eyes, it was just something that I found so hard it just seemed like they were looking right into me. It was just a real disturbing feeling, and, you know, for months, years after that, I actually, you know, to this day, that is the most unbearable part.
That was Travis Walton of Fire in the Sky. And a citizens' hearing on disclosure was held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., from April 29th through May 3rd, 2013. And at that hearing, more than 40 UFO researchers, military officials, and high-ranking political figures presented over 32 hours of testimony before six former congressional representatives and one senator. On August 6, 2013, I played a few of those testimonies on this show, one of which was that of Mr. Richard Dolan. Mr. Dolan was one of the leading UFO researchers and author of UFOs and the National Security State, and AD, After Disclosure. His was one of the most compelling testimonies at the hearing, and bears repeating here. This 10-minute clip puts the UFO matter in a nutshell. That is, that it is real and not a subject for ridicule. There is an official cover-up, and that a free society has the right to know the truth about it. So here then, Mr. Richard Dolan.
Thank you, distinguished members of the committee. And let me just say, it's been an honor for me personally to be here with you all week, to be able to give statements to you and chat with some of you privately as well. regarding disclosure, I have often felt that disclosure on the matter of UFOs and ETs, possible extraterrestrials, is a paradox. It's impossible, but it is inevitable. It's impossible because there is no political motivation for it. It's inevitable, however, because our leaders are not the only factor in this equation. There are other beings, after all. But mainly, I would say there's us, the people, who are going through this greatest social, cultural, and especially technological transformation in the history of humanity. In fact, I would say that we are the game changers. Someday, and it won't be too long in the future, something is going to force someone's hand. It could be a major sighting. It could be a major leak. Something. Something that can no longer be denied. After all, we are fast approaching what experts in artificial intelligence call the singularity, when computing intelligence exceeds our own. In such a future, I ask you, can we really think we will still be stuck in neutral on this issue? Something will force the president's hand. He or she will finally hold that long-awaited press conference and make that bombshell statement. It might go something like this. I have been advised by the National Security Council and heads of our intelligence community that there is a reality to some of the UFO phenomenon, in that some UFOs are real physical craft not manufactured by any known civilization on Earth, or words to that effect. It's the kind of statement that many proponents of UFO disclosure would like to hear, but the real question is, what next? Because who these other beings are and what their agenda or agendas might be. And this will be a very difficult question for any president to answer. In the first place, there is a likelihood that even the leaders of the black budget or breakaway society that have been on top of this for years, they may not even know, or at least not fully. And what if they do know? And moreover, what if at least some of that answer includes information that might be upsetting? Divining the intentions of non-human visitors or permanent residents, whatever they may be, might not be the easiest thing to do. But it's entirely possible, judging from the data we do have, that some of them may not care very much about humanity. Some may, some may not. And what if an agenda has been determined within the intelligence community, and this agenda includes something to do with alleged abduction phenomena? And even if that isn't true, does any president honestly believe he or she can contain rampant speculation along these lines? And even if the intentions of the intelligence, these other beings are said to be neutral or positive, there will clearly be tremendous suspicion by large swaths of humanity. This will not be an easy sell. There will already be a sizable number of people predisposed to interpreting these other beings as nothing less than demonic. Short of bringing one of these entities to a podium and subjecting it to hours and days and weeks of questions by an insatiable public, it's very likely that any moment of disclosure will not satisfy the public the way it would like to be regarding alien motivations. That's only the beginning of the problems. One early and obvious question that will arise, one which will have deep, profound political implications, will be very simple. How have you managed to keep this secret all these years? Consider that our entire society has been told that UFOs do not represent anything truly anomalous, that ETs or aliens are definitely not here on Earth interacting with us, that UFO believers may be well-meaning but had been mistaken about all of that. This has been a mindset embedded within all of our major institutions from private rail for one's career. Throughout our scientific establishment, for sure, and also throughout our political structure. Political careers have been destroyed, or at least severely undermined, by the UFO taint. Remember what happened to Denis Kucinich in 2008, after it became known that many years before he had seen a UFO. Never mind the fact that the two witnesses he had been with came out and corroborated the sighting. They saw the same thing. All of these institutions and others have treated the UFO topic as nothing more than a joke, something suitable for immature minds. Can it really be that the professors throughout the United States uniformly have dismissed this phenomenon without any cooperation from the intelligence community? Ditto the world of science, politics, and media? Well, no. Not when the most modest amount of research shows strong intelligence community influence over all of these institutions. In other words, people will see very clearly that the national security apparatus has created a global culture that has suffocated the truth. Researchers will begin to investigate in a serious way just how these relationships have undermined the credibility of all those institutions and undermined our apprehension of truth. The result will be a major cultural and institutional house cleaning, but it won't stop there. Citizens will naturally want to know specifics about the structure of secrecy itself. That is, they will want to know, if the U.S. president has been out of the loop all these years, as it seems, then who exactly has been in the loop? Who has been running the UFO cover-up? With due respect to Stephen Bassett, that's the phrase that I do use. If the answer is anything along the lines of my own research so far, it will show that the cover-up has long ago gravitated away from formal presidential authority into international and private hands. It's not that the U.S. president is a non-player in all of this, but rather is more like the public face of the true power elite that stands behind. We all, I think, have come to understand this when it comes to power in general, and this will likely be the case when we begin a sophisticated analysis of UFO secrecy. In other words, the moment of disclosure will trigger an intellectual revolution worldwide relating to the true structure of power on planet Earth. It will be a moment in which the world sees and acknowledges that the emperor has been wearing nothing at all. The political fallout will be tremendous, and a great battle will develop within the first year of disclosure. Think of it this way. Just because the president has been forced into making an announcement doesn't mean that the CIA and all the other intelligence groups that have been managing this will simply walk away. There has been a concerted effort spanning an entire human lifetime to control this topic. A great deal has been invested, and mere disclosure is not going to change that. The real issue in the immediate post-disclosure world will be who controls the spin on the story. because right away there would be a great divide, a chasm. Once this topic is available for open discussion, you can be sure that people around the world will be demanding answers. You can be just as sure that on the other side of the fence, information will be handed out as sparingly as possible. Government spin doctors will be out in great numbers trying to control the situation according to national security policy, although this time independent UFO searchers may get a public hearing that they hadn't gotten before. If the official spokespersons are making misleading or false statements, it's going to be a bit easier post-disclosure for independent researchers to point this out, because this time the world will be much more likely to listen. And there will be many, many more investigators into this topic after disclosure than there are today. How all that will turn out, only time will tell. There are so many other messy issues relating to global finance, energy, truth commissions, lawsuits, cultural transformations, cultural wars, religious and spiritual changes, scientific paradigm shifts, and ultimately geopolitical changes that will allow us to meet the challenge of, shall we call them others, here on planet Earth in some sort of coordinated, hopefully logical manner, and even more hopefully in some way that answers to the people rather than a handful of elite human players. And for that, we will need a groundswell of public pressure from below and tremendous political energy, ethics, and courage to take on the black budget culture that has dominated this subject for so long, and to begin a long, hard fight to reclaim some measure of freedom and dignity for humanity while we begin a new, better, and more mature phase of our existence. Thank you.
That was Richard Dolan at the National Press Club Conference in 2013. And here it is, the end of 2025. And we have had congressional hearings in 23 and 24, where many high-ranking figures like whistleblower David Grush, retired Air Force pilot commander David Fravor, known for the Tic Tac incident, and many others have given their testimony under oath as to the UFO-UAP reality. Congress has stated these objects are not U.S. technology, so they're either Russian, Chinese, or quote-unquote other, whatever other might mean. In light of the advanced technologies these objects have displayed over the past several decades, if not longer, I sincerely hope that they're not Russian, Chinese, or any other earthly technologies, or they would have dominated the rest of the world long ago. On the other hand, if an extraterrestrial race meant us harm, it would have already happened. In light of all the official declarations as to the UFO reality, I can hardly see how a presidential disclosure would make it any more official. Either way, the age of disclosure has come to our lifetime. I want to thank the guests I've featured today, as well as the distinguished guests I have had on the show in the past.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archive shows. Or click on the Talk Shows button, then the We Are Not Alone button, for the latest show archives. And please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.